This is Ben Settle of BenSettle.com talking to Ken McCarthy, who's one of my favorite marketing teachers, who I like to call one of the founding fathers of internet marketing. He sponsored the first conference on the subject of the web's commercial potential back in 1994 with the co-founder of Netscape, Mark Andreessen. He was also one of the few people who even thought you could sell online back in the early 1990s, when guys like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates were saying the internet was just a flash in the pan. Until recently, he put on the longest-running internet marketing seminar, the System Seminar, and he still runs the most prestigious and expensive internet marketing club on the planet, the System Club. Plus, he's one of the best copywriters out there, too. Now, you're not going to hear him geeked up by all the copywriting fanboys very much, but his own ads collectively have earned millions of dollars, and he's gotten fan mail about his ads from guys like Gary Bensavanga, who's billed the greatest living copywriter, and Marty Edelston, who's founder of Boardroom Books, one of the biggest direct mail houses in the world. And Dan Kennedy has been using samples of Ken's work for years in his teachings and seminars, including in his best-selling copywriting book, The Ultimate Sales Letter. So anyway, we got him on the line, and I'm going to ask him about the methods to his madness, especially some of the high-level information published in his System Club Letters book, which I recommend everybody buy. So, Ken, how are you, man?
I'm good. Thanks for the introduction.
Yeah, well, I've been wanting to interview you for a while. I mean, we talked way back when I did that copywriting book, but I haven't interviewed you since then.
Which, by the way, is an awesome book that I hope everybody knows about and has a copy of if they're a copywriter or buying copywriting services.
You know what I thought would be kind of fun? Because I've gotten glimpses of what your background is like from going through your copywriting course and just from talking to you over the years. But could you kind of explain your background, like how you started out in Wall Street and you were helping that musician market himself, if I remember correctly, and you helped some production company who did the sound for that movie, that one independent movie, I forget the name of it, and just how all this helped you in marketing.
Well, it's a good question, and I always have been an enthusiast, and I've always been an activist in the sense of if I'm enthusiastic about something, I want to help. And often the best way you can help is create an audience or make sales or get the word out. So my very first experience of that was as a teenager. I went to this private high school. It was unusual school. Everybody went for free. It was all endowed. If you could get in, you went for free. It's called Regis High School in Manhattan. And it was all boys. And, of course, you know, all boys, teenage, you know, we were interested in girls. And so we had our high school dances. And the guys that were running the dances were just completely clueless. So there'd be like, you know, three girls would show up and 59,000 guys. And it was just the saddest scene you could ever imagine. And I couldn't tolerate it. So as a sophomore, an upstart, I gathered a group of my friends and said, we have to do something about this. And we all got together in a room and made posters. And then we made a database of all the girls' schools, because even then and still today, there are a lot of all girls schools in Manhattan. And so we had our database, we had our ad copy, and we just went out and put these posters up at all the girls' schools. The very next dance we did, it was a 2-to-1 ratio in our favor. And suddenly our dances, our monthly dances, went from being the saddest thing in the world to, like, for us at least, for the guys, the most amazing thing. And so, and I was also running the dances too. So we charged, I think, $3 at the door. And, you know, some nights we'd make $1,000, you know, which was in the 70s was a ton of money. You could rent a penthouse, and I'm not even kidding. You could rent a penthouse on Park Avenue for $1,000 a month back in the mid 70s when I was in high school. So that was my first taste of ad copy and database marketing. And I really don't think I've gotten any more sophisticated than that. I've just been in different projects, but it's always the same thing, right? You need to have a project that's good, and you know, we had bands, we had refreshments. It was a dance. I mean, how bad could it be? Then you need a way of framing or positioning what you're doing. Then you need to figure out, okay, who's going to be your most likely market and what are they interested in? And then you have to create the creative, and then you have to deliver the creative to the prospects. And that's, you know, whether you're selling aircraft engines or trying to get more girls at your high school dance, that's the formula. And if, by the way, if any one of those pieces is missing, like if you can't, if you don't have a product that's good, if you don't have a product that meets a like a demand or that you or a demand that you can create through your ad copy, if you don't have a list that you can put your finger on and target, if you don't have copy that is congruent with that offer and with the audience, if you can't get that copy in front of prospects, if you're missing any one of those elements, you don't have a business. And if there's any message that I want to give to folks right now is, if you're thinking of starting a business, please rewind that thing that I just said and write down everything I said and do a checklist and make sure you've got every one of those things, or at least it becomes a task to find those things, because I've seen more good people expend good energy and time, and we're talking sometimes years and certainly tens, if I've seen people blow even more money, trying to make a business where those elements don't come together. So, yeah, so I went from dances, and then I had a roommate who was a guitar player, and I thought he played guitar pretty good, but the world didn't seem to pay much attention to him. He'd get like maybe $20 to play at a coffee house. So I put him on in concerts and stuff, and I actually put him in front of 1,000 people once. And then Blue Note Records heard about him, and they needed a new star, and they thought he was great, and they promoted him, and it turned out that Johnny Carson liked him, and people that are a little my age know that Johnny Carson in those days ruled the world. If you were on Johnny Carson, you were a superstar overnight. And I think he had Stanley, his name was Stanley Jordan, on the show like 18 times, some really large number. And he went from making $20 a night with nobody listening to him to having the best-selling jazz album in the world in 1987. What else did I do? Yeah, I had a buddy that had a film company. He was an innovator in digital media, digital audio for film production, post-production, editing, when no one else was doing it. And he had wired together my Mac 128K, which he upgraded to an Atari reel-to-reel tape recorder and a soundboard and a three-quarter-inch Sony. You can't even imagine how primitive these things were, but somehow it worked. And because we were the only game in town, we weren't the only game in town, we were the low-cost producer in town. So a lot of people came to us with their films, including like Water for Chocolate, which was the best-selling foreign language film in the U.S. for many, many years. And then we also did When We Were Kings, which won the Academy Award for Best Documentary. My Wall Street thing was very interesting. It was I had a little business teaching speed reading. I had a friend who, had a gig on Wall Street. He was doing system design for traders. And because of the teaching that I'd done, this guy had confidence that I could be a technical documenter. And so I got hired as a contractor to go in and do the technical documentation on trading systems for Bankers Trust, which is the biggest trader of foreign exchange in the U.S., and then I went to First Boston. And now, of course, everybody's got 18, everybody that trades at home has 18 screens and, the million feeds and all this kind of stuff. But in those days, just one workstation that we could buy a laptop and some software and buy some services, maybe for $3,000 and be up and running. Something that was 100 times less sophisticated cost us about $250,000 per workstation, from the design to the hardware acquisition to the programming to the training. So I was involved in the technical documentation and the training of that. But what was great is I actually sat on the trading floor. It is literally like a big open floor of Bankers Trust's trading floor. In the 80s, and that was kind of a cool, interesting place to be. I learned Wall Street is as dangerous as you can imagine, and if you're an amateur, you should stay far away from it, but I did see how it really works behind the scenes. And then going on to some, again, this thing of being an enthusiast and an activist, I was in a kind of an accident in, what was it, late 80s, and I moved to San Francisco because I thought the weather would be a little easier for me. And in that neighborhood, I read a little article about this local guy that was doing, quote, multimedia, digital multimedia. This was 1990, and he was doing conferences. And I called him up because I was always interested in media, and I saw that his ads were terrible. And I volunteered. I just, hey, I said, look, hey, you know, I'll let me rewrite your ads for you. So I rewrote his brochure, and for the next 4 or 5 years, he was never able to change or improve one word in that brochure, and he must have mailed it thousands and thousands of times. He was sponsored by IBM and Apple and Microsoft, and he was one of the guys that taught people how to make CD-ROMs before CD-ROMs were a commercial thing in the stores. And then right there, then came the internet, and luckily I was in the right place at the right time. San Francisco was sort of, you know, Grand Central Station for all the great internet entrepreneurs, and I saw this weird gap. I saw all these CD-ROM producers that didn't know squat about the internet, and I saw all these internet guys that didn't know squat about business or the idea of publishing or the idea of making money, as he said. I mean, they were all into giving information away for free and creating incredible technical resources. And I was like, great, why don't you charge for this? And why don't we make a commercial publishing industry out of this? So there was one young guy who was really smart, and I thought he was smart, and I guess I was right. His name's Mark Andreessen, and now he's a big venture capitalist, and he co-founded Netscape. But I luckily met him before Netscape was even an idea. And we were emailing back and forth because we were trying to figure out, gee, how is the web going to make money? He had his ideas, and he's kind of stuck to them. And I've had my ideas, and I've kind of stuck to them. And we were both right. He's more into the big enterprise, you know, big picture, big deal kind of thing. And I just love small business and small ventures and people having their own businesses. And I like direct response, and so I went in that direction. Anyway, we put on that conference together, and it put me kind of like right at the beginning of the whole web revolution. And then I had to endure the dot-com insanity, which went on for years and years, where everybody thought if you just put up a website and throw $1 million or $2 million or $10 million or $20 million at it, you'd get rich. That collapsed, and then people started to get smart about direct response. And, of course, Google, and I don't know if people think about this, but Google's AdWords, which grew up in the smoldering wreck of a crater of the dot-com era, Google AdWords is a direct response medium. And so I think I was right. I think I was right that the money was going to be made on direct response on the internet, the solid money, the real money. And I think Google's proved that. And, you know, I got so disgusted in San Francisco with the dot-com thing, I actually left San Francisco in 1998. Just before, about 2 years before the crash, I saw it coming, and I it was just, this whole environment was crazy. People that didn't know what they were talking about were getting funded to the tune of to $20 million. And meanwhile, sensible ideas couldn't get any attention. So I moved back east to where I'm from. I lived in, went up and lived in a quiet place, the Hudson Valley, where I still have a house. And, then I'll tell you, I never really told the story to people, but then 9/11 happened, and you know, I had worked, like I said, I had worked in Bankers Trust. Well, Bankers Trust was connected to the South Tower by a pedestrian bridge, and if I had been in the World Trade Center once, I've been in it 10,000 times, eating lunch, getting my hair cut, buying books, taking the train. And when that happened, I thought to myself, you know, if I hadn't found direct response and hadn't found the internet, there's a good chance I could have been in one of those buildings, because I would have probably gone in the financial services route and stuck with that. And then I thought to myself, wow, here I am sitting in Tivoli, you know, living a really nice life, knowing all this stuff and not really teaching much. And I had pretty much stopped teaching around 97 in an active way. And I was just doing, you know, talks here and there. But after that happened, I said, you know what, I've got to get serious, and I got to, you know, make some contribution. And so what I did was I organized the first seminar on internet marketing that included the idea of AdWords and pay-per-click and testing as its base. That was in 2000 and, oh, my goodness, was it, when was it? Well, I did an off-radar one in 2001, right? But then the system, I believe, started in 2002, didn't it? I can't even remember. I think it was 2002. And, you know, all the stuff that you see now, you know, use AdWords to figure out what your headline should be, you know, track your keywords, long tail, I mean, we were the guys with that stuff in 2002, and we laid it all out. I still have the tapes of everything, and I defy anybody to find any training that occurred before that date that was as thorough and as comprehensive and as integrated as what we presented then. And I think everything that's come since then, it flows right out of our insights. Now, did we discover this stuff? Well, did Columbus discover America? Not really. America was already there, right? And did I discover all this stuff? No, but I did get in the ship and I sailed across the Atlantic and I put a flag in the ground. And I think we did something really significant for you know, small business people and entrepreneurs. And I don't mind bragging that tens of thousands of people who are making money on the internet, if they trace it back all the way to where the idea that they're using work started, it started at the system seminar. So, but, and all this came out of just being an enthusiastic guy who also had an activist bent and knew that if you want something to happen, you got to go out and sell. So it started with the high school chances and it ended up on the internet. So that's my story.
You know, I never had a chance to go to a system seminar, but I remember you sent me the tapes of the 2008 one and you had me write some bullets for it and stuff. And you were talking about how earlier how you keep it real kind of simple. It's all the basics. And you did this joint speech with Lloyd Irvin at that one, and I'll never forget it. It was like it was marketing for beginners. And people are asking you, I think, like, well, do we need to use Facebook? Do we need to do all this like technical stuff? And you guys are like, look, at the end of the day, it comes down to squeeze page, sales letter, and relentless follow-up. And that had just stuck with me ever since.
Well, you know, I love talking with Lloyd because Lloyd's a martial artist, and there's a couple of fields in the world, like martial arts, like stock trading, interestingly enough, and there's probably some others I'm not thinking of, but they're fields where you get instant feedback. You can't pretend that you're winning. You know, if you step into a ring with somebody and they tear your head off, you can't say that was a great branding experience. You know, you lost, right? And it's the same thing if you're a stock or a futures trader. You know, at the end of the day, you look at your win-loss, and if you're down, you're down. And you can't pretend that, oh, you know, tomorrow's another day. Well, tomorrow is another day, of course, but you lost that day. And direct response marketing. So those are the three: martial arts, stock and futures trading, and direct response marketing. These fields do not let you pretend that you're a genius, right? You have numbers that are generated, and those numbers are what the numbers are, and they're either good or they're bad or they're indifferent. And you know, you've got to, if you intend to persist, you've got to adjust. And so, yeah, I love teaching with Lloyd. And the thing about martial arts and trading too, and I've done both, is the fundamentals and marketing, of course, the fundamentals are everything. There is never a point in your career. There is never a point in your company's business. There's never a point in the economy. There's never a point ever when you shouldn't begin the day with at least some kind of mental review of what the fundamentals of what it's all about are about, because it's very easy to get swept up by Twitter and Facebook and, you know, the million and one fads that have come and gone. It's so easy to get swept up in that. And that's not where it's at. You know, where it's at are these very bread and butter, mundane, fundamental issues that you're either covering or you're not. And if you're not covering them, well, you know, one of the great things that we came up with, and it's very simple, I was sort of at my wit's end trying to detoxify and de-brainwash even the first audience that we had in 2002, because they were already full of nonsensical ideas from the media, from bogus gurus, from all kinds of half-baked sources. And finally I said, look, guys, it's traffic plus conversion. That's it. Forget everything else. Are you getting traffic? Are you converting the traffic? That's 80% of your daily focus. If you're focusing on, you know, fine-tuning, you know, the wing nut on the defibrillator, you're wasting your time. The only thing that matters is audience and pitch and what numbers come out the other end, and adjusting both to maximize your return. So we developed that formula. internet marketing is traffic plus conversion equals profits. And Lloyd, it's interesting that you mentioned Lloyd because he swears that's the basis of his business, and he's hitting high of seven figures every year in sales from starting from zero, you know.
You bring up martial arts and fundamentals, and I don't know. You probably get a kick out of this because you always come up with these cool analogies. And there's a story about the cocky kid who goes to the martial arts guy and, you know, teach me how to, you know, kick someone's ass. And so the guy's like, well, first you have to learn to punch. And I already know how to punch. He goes, teach me the advanced stuff. And so the martial arts master goes to this candle and punches so fast that it puts the candle out. And the cocky kid's like, yeah, show me how to do that. And he goes, well, first you have to learn how to punch, you know, in the first place. And it totally reminds me of that, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, there's another martial arts story, if you'll indulge me, that's really useful, too. There were these two guys that had this battle. They met. They were both masters. And the one guy just trounced the other guy. And the guy that lost said, I don't understand. I train hard 8 hours a day, every day. I never miss. I do this. I do that. And the other master said, yeah, but I train all the time. I train 24 hours a day. And what that story talks about is I'm always thinking about positioning and marketing and packaging of everything. And I'm always looking at how things are packaged. Like there's no time when I don't sit down for a few hours every once in a blue moon and think about marketing. I'm always looking at the world through a sort of a marketer's lens. You know, when I see politicians speak, I say, oh, I see what he's up to. When I hear the nonsense out of Wall Street, I go, oh, I see what they're up to. And so I'm constantly thinking about that. So if I gave another piece of advice from the martial arts world, is don't just go to the dojo and practice a couple of hours a day. Practice when you're opening doors. Practice when you're walking. Practice when you're breathing. Just always be thinking about your art, and which might be marketing or it might be martial arts or whatever it is.
That's an interesting way. You have a story about that in your System Club Letters book where you're talking about how you took the train into New York. And it was really cold, and everybody was like, there's like 20 people at a cab stand, and then you looked across the street at the old Pennsylvania Hotel, and there's like two people, and you just walked across the street, and you got in a cab right away while the crowd was following, you know, the other side of the street.
It was so weird, and there's another piece to that story, which was, I looked at that long line in front of the train station, and then I looked across, and I saw there was only two people waiting in front of this hotel, and I thought, And this we all go through this, by the way, and it's one of the biggest challenges in life, right? So I'm looking at this line of 20 thinking, they must know something I don't know, right? Because there's 20 of them. And then I'm looking at the guy across the street, and I go, but there's only two of them. They don't know as much as those 20 people. But then finally I just said, look, I'm freezing. I'm going to go with the short line. And even as I was crossing the street, I'm thinking, I might be making a mistake here. But of course it turned out, the cabs came, they picked us up. We were out of there in 2 seconds while everybody's else shivering in line. And, I think you and I talked earlier about maybe talking about the economy at the end of this call. And that little story has a lot to do with the economy and how to read the economy too, but we won't jump ahead.
Okay. There was another, I think one of my, this may very well be my favorite part of the book. System Club Letters, which I think everybody, I mean, I say this all the time, literally everyone in business, I think, should read it. Not once, not twice, but multiple times. And it's at the beginning, and you're talking about improvisation and jazz and how a lot of high-level marketers are raging jazz fans. Can you explain that a little bit? Because I just thought that actually changed my thinking on a lot of things.
Well, I think it's just a coincidence, but it turns out that, for instance, Michael Fishman, who is one of the great marketing strategists, especially in the health arena of all time. I mean, if there's a Hall of Fame for health marketers, he's got to be in it. Perry Marshall, which I have to brag, started as a student at the System Seminar, got his first speaking opportunity on AdWords at the System Seminar, was introduced to the 80-20 rule at the System Seminar. He's a huge jazz fan. Our good friend, Oh, please don't make me forget. Let me go across the room and read the book. My brain's a little challenged today. I got rear-ended in a car thing a couple of days ago, and I'm still a little rattled, so I'm forgetting names. But let me go across. Drayton Bird. Sorry, there it is, Drayton Bird. Drayton Bird, who's like super heavyweight of direct marketing. I mean, David Ogilvy hired Drayton, not only bought Drayton's direct marketing agency in the UK, but he hired Drayton to go around the world and train his affiliate offices in direct marketing principles. Drayton's a huge jazz fan. In fact, I took Drayton and Perry to the new apartment lounge to see Von Freeman, which unfortunately he can't do anymore because Von passed away. But that was one of the great jazz experiences on earth, and we all went together and had a great time. Steve O'Keefe, who was the guy that taught Jeff Bezos how to sell books on the internet, raging jazz fan. All right. It could just be a coincidence. And it doesn't, and I'm not saying everybody should go out and, you know, become a jazz fan. But the thing that you learn in jazz, the thing that you learn to appreciate in jazz, is that jazz musicians know the fundamentals inside and out, but they're masters of improvisation. In other words, they don't ever think, well, I can just sleep my way through this. You know, I'm just going to get up on stage there and just sort of, you know, dial it in, call it in. No, every time they go up to do something, they're creating, they're inventing, they're trying new things. And that's called improvisation. And the ability, I think the ability to improvise is the most important skill an entrepreneur can have. Because one thing I can guarantee you, your business plan is not going to unfold the way you thought it would. Things are going to happen. Things are going to come up. Some of them will be good. Some of them will be bad. Some of them will be, you know, seem like they're going to shut you down. Other things are going to be these opportunities that you never even imagined existed that you have to scramble to take advantage of. It's all about improvisation. And unfortunately, our education system, which I think is appallingly bad in the United States, I don't care what nonsensical statistics people put out there, I think the public education system in the United States is making people stupid. Unfortunately, our education system is stealing that natural inborn ability that everyone's born with to improvise. I mean, babies improvise very well. Small children improvise extremely well. And then we get taught somehow in school that we're supposed to do A, B, and C, and in that order, and that's it, and that's the only approved way, and if you do it any other way, you're going to get in trouble. That is death to anybody that wants to do anything practical in this world, because the world is a fluid, ever-changing thing. And if you can't figure out how to change with the changing conditions, you better get a job at the post office. Because it's just not going to work as an entrepreneur. So, you know, develop that muscle. You know, we've all got the improvisational muscle. Develop it. You know, keep working on it. It gets better and better all the time. And you ebb and flow. Sometimes you get in a rut and you're not really thinking that well. And other times you're just coming up with really good stuff. Same thing happens to musicians. They run through phases where they're just red hot and they're coming up with all kinds of great stuff and they're responding well to everything. And then they'll have other times where they just don't feel inspired. But the point is, and I never hear this talked about in business training, and I have lectured at, you know, Columbia University Business School. I lectured, I think, once or twice at MIT Sloan School. And I lectured once at URIS. URIS is Columbia. I forget the name of it, the one at NYU. And, you know, those guys are all being taught. Some of them will be entrepreneurs, and some of them will be improvisers. I guess the word that's used in business a lot is innovator. Well, innovator implies that you have this grand idea, and, you know, that's the end. You know, you're an innovator. I'd rather be an improviser than an innovator. But anyway, my point is, whether it's at the highest levels at these graduate business schools or whether it's at the community college or whether it's at an internet training, I don't think enough emphasis is put on the fact that everybody's got to become an improviser. So that's my take on jazz and improvisation and business.
Yeah, that's good. And you know, especially, you know, my main thing that I teach is email marketing, and it's like that. I just wish everybody who does email would apply that, because everybody is so stuck on rules, you know. And well, where do you put the first link? And it, like there's some rule that you have to do everything a certain way, and it's like no. You know, it's like jazz.
Well, it's okay when you're a beginner, you know, when you're learning something to copy a form, you know, not literally copy somebody's stuff, but I mean, you know, mimic or model yourself after somebody. That's absolutely fine. It's almost necessary, but you want to grow out of that as soon as possible. And if you're going to get the best results, you're going to have to think. And that's hard. You know, thinking's hard. That's why it's such highly paid work. You know, you can go to a factory and you know, screw in a nozzle or something, you know, eight hours a day, and you'll make a certain number of hour, you know, dollars per hour, no thinking involved. But the guy that's designing the assembly line and designing the machine and all this stuff, those guys get paid really well. And then the guy that's, you know, organizing the factory and organizing the marketing or is organizing the company, you know, ideally he gets paid really, really well. And it really is all a matter of thinking. So it's certainly okay to start out and just sort of be a mimic, you know, and maybe not too, you know, imaginative, but because that gets somebody in the game, you know, that gets you in the game. It's so important to get in the game. That's another issue, right? We don't want to be reading books for 20 years and then finally trying our first venture. You really want to just get in the game. And it's, you know, getting in the game awkwardly today is 100,000 times better than getting in the game from an informed point of view 20 years from now. Somebody once said this, and I loved it: perfection in infinite time is worth zero. You know, and that's a whole other part of this. And jazz musicians, if we go back to that, will tell you they learn the most from their mistakes. You know, from trying something in a solo that doesn't work, and then maybe discovering something valuable in that mistake, something that they wouldn't have thought of had they done it right the first time. You know, we've all heard this, and you know, I don't want to beat the dead horse on this, but the truth is you learn from your mistakes. You don't really learn from your successes. So you're so much better off, you know, once you've got an idea, going out and trying to execute on it and having all the mistakes in the world and then improvising your way to solutions to make the next round better.
Yeah, that's interesting, because not too long ago, the great, I'll call him legendary marketer, Jim Straw, passed away. And I don't know if he did this on purpose because he knew he was, like, passing away or not, but, like, the last email he sent out that I got, at least, was, like, all the things he's learned in business. And one of them was he never got paid anything for his successes. It was all his failures that he learned from.
Fantastic. Wow, you know, I've been out of it. I didn't know he passed away. That was a great, great educator.
Yeah, he was one of those guys who could get away with just signing blatant sales pitches every day, and he didn't care.
You know? His presentation was still interesting.
It was. It was really good.
He's one of the guys from the paper and ink days, and you know, those guys are getting rarer and rarer. And if you get a chance to learn from one of them, you know, Dan Kennedy's an example, Trayton Bird's an example, Gary Bensavenga's an example. You know, those guys, what they know is incalculably valuable, because you know, the internet is, you know, it's a pretty forgiving medium. Paper and ink was not forgiving. If you screwed up, you died. And so the level of thought and intention and study that those guys put in to make their stuff work, it's so beyond 99.99999% of anything you'll find from an internet expert. So anyway, rest in peace, Jim Straw, a great guy, a great educator.
Yeah, that was a very – I saved all of his email. I still read through that stuff. And okay, I have to ask you about this, because everybody asks – like, this is like the big question that always comes in, and that's about list building. And like, what's a good way for someone who's just starting out, or maybe someone who's been in it a while, but they want to grow their list in a good way with quality people – what's a good way for someone to start building their list, their email list?
Well, yeah, it's an important question, and by necessity, it's a general question. It's easier if you said, oh, I've got a business selling widgets, and I've got this website, and we get a certain amount of traffic, and we do things this way, and then I could give a really precise answer. But let's talk about some basic principles.
Okay.
The, the first thing is it helps. And I know this sounds ridiculously simple, but it helps to have the intention to build a list. Like a lot of, I see so many people will start a business and operate a business, and they never give any thought to building a list at all. There's a famous marketer, and he once commented to me that the internet people were driving him crazy because for many internet guys who hit on the right market with the right traffic with the right formula. In some of these high volume things like diet, let's take for example, if you get that right, I mean you can just bank ridiculous amounts of money. And this paper and ink marketer had been in the diet field, and what drove him nuts was the internet guys would make their sale, take the money, and then go to the next sale. They didn't do anything with their list. They were accumulating these lists of known diet buyers. And this applies to anything. I just happened to be using diet because it was such an extreme example. They were, by selling, just by virtue of selling, they were creating an incredibly valuable list of response lists, and they didn't even have, they had no intention. They had no intention about what to do with this data. So it starts with intention and understanding the incredible value of your data. And let me just talk about this in case anybody's forgotten, and I forget too, so I have to remind myself. If somebody inquires with you about your product or service, or they say yes to a free offer, or they, opt into to your list, that's an amazing thing. You've taken a name that has pretty much no value, and you've automatically increased its value, dramatically. You now have somebody who at least at one point in their life had an interest in what you were doing and took many steps forward towards you. That's worth a lot. The next level of value, of course, is when somebody makes a trial purchase. They make their first purchase from you. That's really, really valuable. And then even more valuable is somebody that's just made that trial purchase and then come back and bought a second and third and fourth time. It's important when you're envisioning your business to clearly realize the relative value of all those different phases, the person that makes the inquiry, the person that makes the first purchase, the person that's done a couple of purchases, and to market and communicate with those elements of your list differently. So in other words, you would invest more time and money and effort in somebody that's made multiple purchases from you than you would in somebody that's just a prospect. Or somebody that's only made one purchase. But you would take all those people extremely seriously. So that's where this begins, realizing that if you're in business, you're really in the list business, and you're in the refining of your list business, refining prospects into first-time purchasers and first-time purchasers into second-time purchasers and second-time purchasers into multiple purchasers. So starting with this fundamental understanding that no matter what you're selling, you're really in the list business, I think will help people a lot. The second thing I would say, and I heard this from Dan Kennedy, who I think heard this from somebody else, that he didn't know one way to get 100 new customers, but he knew 100 ways to get one new customer. And that's one of the realities a lot of people don't want to face. They want one magic, easy, emphasis on the easy, method for getting lots and lots of prospects and lots of names on their list. And it just usually doesn't work that way. You usually have to be working lots and lots and lots of different angles and possibilities and potentials and getting a little bit from here and a little bit from there. And in the aggregate, it becomes something significant. So I think that's another outlook that would really help people that want to build their lists. You really should wake up every day. If you're in active business building mode, you really should wake up every day and go, okay, what's a brand new source of prospects that I didn't know yesterday? And, get the answer to that and get some movement towards hooking yourself up to that new source of names. The best way, it's very important to design your websites in such a way that they engage people. And engage them not just by being interesting, but by making an irresistible offer, an offer that you can't say no to. If you have a website that just sort of tells people a lot of stuff but doesn't give away some amazing thing for free that's relevant to your offer, you're making a huge mistake, especially on the internet. That was always a mistake in classic direct marketing, but it's a ridiculous mistake in internet marketing. Why? Because it's so easy to give away lots and lots of amazingly attractive, valuable, relevant things to prepare somebody to buy from you. Not to do that is really nuts. So, you know, have the intention, understand that you're in the list business no matter what business you think you're in. Realize that you're going to have to get your names from probably a lot of different sources. You know, you might hit the home run. You might get lucky, but generally you're going to have to get a little from here and a little from there. And then the other thing that's so important is to give them a reason to give you their name. Give them a reason to join your list. Give them a reason. And I used to say this when I taught a lot. It's as hard to give something away for free as it is to sell something, you know, for $1 million sometimes. You don't just say free, exclamation point, and think that's going to do anything. You know, maybe a certain small percentage of the population will respond solely to free. But what you really have to do is craft something and craft an offer that just has an irresistible hook for your particular market. So, for instance, let's say you're selling digital cameras. And you want to go beyond the person that just does a search, comes to your site, looks for the best price, and buys or doesn't buy. What I would do is I would create a video series or an ebook or something or an interview with experts on how to buy digital cameras. What matters? What should you look for? What are the key things, the key features? I mean, I remember I'm surprisingly untechnical, and I decided years ago when finally after digital cameras had already been around for a while, by golly, I'm going to buy a digital camera. I had the money, but I didn't know what to buy. And it was like so much work, and no place that I went was willing to provide me with some of the education about what the issues were when you're buying a digital camera. And I ended up buying the one that a friend told me to buy. She just said, buy this camera. I said, okay, I'll buy it. But I'll tell you, if one company had just simply put up an ebook saying, here's what this means, and here's what, you know, I don't know, 5, 10, 8, I don't even know what these things are. I don't know anything really about digital cameras. But they would, when you go to buy something like a digital camera, they give you all the specs, and they don't even tell you what the specs mean or what their significance is or what's the difference between 8 megabytes and 16 megabytes. What's the difference? I don't know, you know. So if somebody had simply done that, I would have gladly given them my name in exchange for some education. And once they had my name, what did they have? They had the name of a guy who's got money burning a hole in his pocket trying to buy a digital camera. If you can't make a business off a list like that, you know, it's hopeless, right? So I don't know if this answers the question, but since it was kind of a general question, I'm just giving an answer in generalities and principles, but I think it'll hopefully give people some things to chew on and work with.
No, that's great. And it kind of dovetails into something that is in your System Club Letters book. And you have this chapter on care and maintenance of your list, which I thought was absolutely, I mean, it just must know information. Can you kind of talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, this is an example where the old print, and they all hate me to call them the old, you know, and I don't mean they're old. I just mean, you know, it's an era that has been around a long time. The old paper and ink guys understood this. And see, I'm lucky because I had several years where I was doing mailings pre-internet, before the internet came along, for a business that I owned. And, you know, I would go down to the mail house and I'd write out these multi-$1,000 checks, and then we'd sit around biting our nails for a week praying that, you know, the money was going to come back, you know. That kind of rigor and discipline, I can't tell you what it's worth. But anyway, the point that I wanted to say about that is when you are mailing physically, you pay a lot of attention to that list of yours because you acquired it at great cost. And even on the internet these days, you acquire your names at cost, at significant cost, right? So let's say an example of clothing. You don't want to buy beautiful, expensive clothing and then put it in your basement next to your oil burner and forget that it's there, and then come down, you know, at Christmas time and say, oh, I need to put on a suit to go to church or something. And you know, you've neglected this suit. It's been lying in a puddle of oil and, you know, You know what I mean? And that's how people treat their customer lists. They just sort of have them and, yeah, whatever, you know, we'll do a promotion every blue moon. No, you really have to, because here's the deal. Lists rot. They're just like fruit. If you're not mailing to them, if you're not and it's not so much the mailing that makes a difference, so that helps. It's the stimulation and you're stimulating them on a regular basis. You're interacting with them. You're directing their attention from all the million things they could direct their attention to you and to your business and to your offers. And you're doing that on a regular basis. You know, the minimum in the print, some of this had to do with economics and the cost of production and the cost of mailing. But in the minimum, you should never let a month go by where you don't contact your list with something. Something interesting, something useful, something helpful. It just could be a flat out offer. Hopefully your offer is interesting and useful, and we could talk about that maybe. But you know, bottom line, if you think you have a list of 100,000, but you've neglected them for a year, you do not have a list of 100,000 anymore. You have a list that's, you know, rotted down, and you can take the best list in the universe and by neglect reduce it to a unresponsive mess. So. You got to take care of your list, and the best way to take care of your list is to interact with it. It's like friends or live customers. You know, if you neglect them for months or years, you know, they're going to drift away and forget. So that's basically, it's just sort of common sense, but it's a mistake I've seen made a million times by internet marketers, not so much print marketers, because print and mail marketers, because they know they can't afford to do it. But internet marketers make this mistake all the time. They also make another mistake, which is not to segment their lists. They'll, you know, instead of creating special mailings and special offers for their buyers and their heavy buyers, they'll just send the same offer to everybody. And that's a mistake. That's a mistake. You really should think, you know, I've got prospects that are interested. My job is to convert them to trial buyers. I've got trial buyers. My job is to get them to buy again as quickly as possible, because that's a simple thing. But again, the old school paper and ink guys realized this really early. One sale does not a customer make. It's the second and most importantly that third sale where you've really got somebody. And once you've got a customer, now you've got a real business. So if somebody's a prospect, crafting something to make them make the leap into being a trial buyer. If they're a guy that's made the first purchase, getting them to make that second purchase and that third purchase. And having all that planned out in advance is very, very important. So all that is part and parcel of thinking about your list and not letting your list rot away.
And that kind of reminds me, you and I have talked about this before when you interviewed me for your System Club. And we were talking about email frequency and how people like look at, if you mail daily, which I do, and I know you do at least with one or two of your businesses, right? And one of the
ones I've got a bunch I've been on. I have a bunch of businesses that are based on one or two times a day mailing.
Yeah, and people will look at you like you're a freak or something when you tell them that, but that's the way to do it, right? I mean, that's just the way it works online.
If you've got good material and you have value to share and they're an interested list, absolutely. Mailing to somebody every day is not spam. Mailing junk to them is spam. Mailing, you know, stupid offers to them is spam. But if somebody opts in and you let them know what the deal is up front, mailing to them every day is a service. You know, if you're into something, there's nothing better than getting something cool about that thing you're into every day, and it does form quite a bond between you and the customer and the prospect.
And you know what? I'm thinking back to your copywriting course, and you said something real interesting in that, where you were like, if you just get them to click a link, where when they go, wherever they go, they have a good experience. You've just bonded with that person another notch higher than you were before.
Right. The idea of micro conversions. You know, everybody thinks, you know, did he buy? Did he not buy? Did he opt in? Did he not opt in? Well, you know, you may encounter that prospect again in another circumstance. So even even if you don't get the opt-in right away or you don't get the sale right away, it's still important to focus on moving them along the line, down the line of becoming a customer. And you need to think in terms of micro conversions. There's a lot, everybody, for instance, should take their sales process and really break it down. Where is somebody at mentally before they even see your first offer? What's their mental experience when they encounter your first offer? What options do you give them to engage with you? Are you giving them enough options? Are you just saying buy or die? Or are you giving them buy or try? Or buy or get this free trial sample first. So that's another micro conversion point. And then of course once they've done something to come towards you, then now they're in a new state. It's states of mind. Imagining and thinking through what all those states of mind are that start from a cold stranger to someone that's an enthusiastic customer. There's a lot of conversions in between the ones that you can measure, I guess is my point. We can measure we can measure a click, we can measure an opt-in, we can measure a sale, but there's a lot of other things that are going on in the process of converting a stranger to a happy customer that are a little less tangible, and yet they're as real can be. And one of our skills that we need to develop as marketers is the ability to imagine, and specifically the ability to imagine ourselves into the mindset of the people we're selling to. Where are they at right now at this stage in the process, and what can I do to move them ever closer to the actions that make the business money? It's something that's a little hard to describe, so I think I've described it as best as I can. But I think if you take the time to look at your sales process and go beyond just did they convert or not convert, you'll get some benefit from this kind of thinking.
I want to segue now into copywriting. And one of the chapters in your book where you talk about form versus fire, and you have this great analogy about Hollywood actors when they phone it in. And how that's what a lot of the copywriting is these days.
Oh, yeah. I mean, oh, my God, I get these letters, and it looks like somebody threw a bunch of words into an automatic sales letter machine, and out came this canned letter that you could just, instead of selling, painting lessons, you could be selling tuna fish, or instead of selling tuna fish, you could be selling digital cameras. Somebody got a checklist of the things they're supposed to do in a letter, which is not a bad thing, right? But what's a bad thing is if you just stay in the checklist form-only approach to copywriting. If you look at the letters that have launched and sustained great businesses, they all share one thing in common. They're just fresh. They're unique. Not unique for the sake of being unique, but just they're genuine. Gary Halbert, for example, copywriter who, he's definitely, I call him, a wild man. But if you read his copy and you look at how he wrote, there was no formula. He just told the story as clearly, number one, and as authentically, number two, and then as vividly, number three, as it could be told. And every letter that he wrote was different. And if you look at any great copywriter, you're going to see the same thing. Yes, they know all the formulas, and they know all the checklist of things that you need to do. You have to have a call to action, blah, blah, blah. You have to have bullet points. You have to have this. You have to have that. You have to know that stuff. But to have a great letter, you have to be like a human being communicating in a compelling, fresh way to other human beings. And that's fire. That's that's the fire in people. So, I have sympathy for people that are trying to learn copywriting because it's not easy. But on the other hand, I got to advise everybody that is learning, learn the techniques and then throw them away and get real. Get real. I mean, there's a case, and I wish I had the details at my fingertips, but. Well, actually, I can think of another case. But there are cases where guys have who had no copywriting. Keep this in mind, everybody. There's at least two major cases in the history of direct mail where somebody who had no copywriting experience whatsoever sat down and wrote a grand slam home run direct mail letter. Now, they had two things in common. Both of them had been salesmen. They had actually gone, in one case, door to door, and sold. Well, I mean, this, and I'm so sorry, I can't remember his name.
Ed McLean, isn't it?
Ed McLean. Thank you so much.
You wrote it in your book, so I remembered it.
No, I can't remember anything. That's why I write things down. This guy sold pots and pans door to door in New Orleans. I mean, or Brooklyn, or some place that, believe me, is not easy to go door to door, right? And then he decided he needed a job, and he drifted into Time magazine, and they said, "Hey, kid, write a letter." And all right. And he wrote a letter, and that thing was one of the most mailed letters of all time. So the point is, he didn't have the formulas, he didn't have the format, he didn't have the instant sales letter generator that he bought for only $9.99 off the internet. He had a sense of human-to-human communication and fire. And he figured out how to make a clear, compelling message to somebody. And that's what sells ultimately. It's not the formulas. Again, you need to know them. It's useful to know them, but it's not the formulas that are going to make the magic. It's clear, authentic, compelling, interesting communication. And that's, there's a little bit of art in that. I got to say something too about being a copywriter. In the word copywriter, there is the word writer. And I just want to say, if you're not a writer, you're probably not going to be a copywriter. And I know there's a million people teaching courses out there, and, hey, be a copywriter and blah, blah, blah. But you know what? Writing's a craft. It's like plumbing. It's like wiring houses. It's like, putting shingles on a roof. It's a craft. And it's the kind of thing you do every day. And that's how you get good at it. And the idea that you could, buy a book and learn a couple of formulas and the next day be crafting, useful copy, I don't think so. I really don't think so. I think, you've got to develop, even if you're not a writer in the sense of somebody that's writing, articles and, books and stuff like that, you have to be somebody who's communicating on a daily basis in a purposeful way, or verbally, orally, or in writing. You can't just be somebody that's never given any thought at all to communication and spends no time at all at improving your communication and think that you're going to get somewhere in copywriting in the long run. It's not going to happen that way. I hope I'm not bursting anybody's bubbles listening to this. Now, on the positive side, if you are a communicator, if you are a writer, if you are someone that likes to speak or someone that likes to teach, this can be molded into a very valuable and therefore lucrative skill, because there's a shortage of people in the world that can explain things well. There's a shortage of people in the world that can motivate other people. There's a shortage of people in the world that can capture other people's imagination. So, maybe you've never made any money. You've been a writer and you've done all those things and you've never made any money and you're despairing, as I was years and years ago. But if you stick with it and you look for commercial applications of that skill, in time, you will find a lot of rich potential and opportunity for you, because the world is in desperate need all the time of people who can speak well and write well, and that means clarity, authenticity, and generating interest, which is the essence of copywriting. It's not flim-flam. It's not, mental gymnastics and ninja mind control techniques. I think that's nonsense. It's that thing that people most are looking for in this world, which is an interesting, authentic, genuine communication from another person. That always wins the day. So that's my thought about that.
It reminded me of something you said earlier when you were talking about the jazz thing and improv, and then you're like, learn the rules, but then learn when to throw the rules away. And I was talking to Doberman Dan about a direct mail thing that we've been talking about, and we got to thinking, everybody's, and I'm not saying not to use headlines in your copy or anything, but it's interesting how two of the most mailed letters in history, the Calvert Coat of Arms ad and the Wall Street Journal ad, neither of them really had a headline. you know. Just interesting, something to think about for people, just to kind of get out of that boxed mindset.
Yeah, you have to think, you know, it's trite, but you have to think outside the box. Those two letters were unique in that the match of offer to list was just darn near perfect. And that was Halbert's genius in that coat of arms business. And then that Wall Street Journal thing, people have to be careful about that letter, because, you know, it's like there's, you know, in especially in those days when that letter was a big hit, if you wanted to be in business, there was only one thing to do. There was only one thing to read, and that was the Wall Street Journal. So it's almost like mailing a letter saying, hey, you know that blue blazer you're supposed to have for tomorrow's meeting? Here's where you get it. Now, I don't mean to diminish or take anything away from that sales letter or how successful it was or how impactful it was. But you have to remember, too, that's the business story and the milieu behind the success of that particular letter. You always have to look at that. There's no such thing as a letter that floats out in space and does magic. The letter is going to a particular audience at a particular time in history on behalf of a particular product. And I'm not saying that any letter would have worked as well as the letter that guy wrote, but I'm saying that all kinds of letters would have worked to that list, because you're basically saying, hey, you're in the club, and to attend the meetings, you need a blue blazer, and here's where you get the blue blazer. And in the 1950s and 60s of business, you needed to have the Wall Street Journal, and if you wanted to be in the club. And so it was just really a matter of, okay, it's time for me to get my subscription. Again, not to take anything away from that letter. And on the Halbert side, that it's not so much that the letter was a work of genius, it was that the whole conception was a work of genius. The idea of buying directory names, essentially, not response names, if I understand correctly. There's a difference between, I'm drawing a blank on the name, but there's you can get the name of everybody that has a fishing license in New York. Okay, that tells you something. Tells you who's a fisherman, supposedly, but it doesn't tell you who's responsive to direct response. Now, to get a list of people who are – this is gold, what I'm telling you right now, and it took me years to get this through my thick skull. It might take you a little time too, people listening to this, but please study what I'm saying here, because it's where everything flows. The value of a list of known buyers through a direct response medium is way more valuable than just, hey, I know the guy's a fisherman, okay? It's way more valuable to know that he's a fisherman and he bought the Wall Street Journal, for instance, from a direct response pitch. Doesn't even matter that he's ever bought fishing gear or not from direct response. The idea that he has used direct response before makes somebody just exponentially more valuable than just a cold person. So you have to keep that in mind. I forget why I mentioned that, but it's a very important thing when you're looking at your lists. Oh yeah, well, so when Halbert looked at that phenomenon and he saw that response lists, good ones, are very expensive, so he said, well, how can I find a directory type list that has no special premium on it and make money from it? And he learned that he could get all the McCarthys in the world cheap. A list of all the McCarthys, and he could get a list of all the Settles in the world and all the Smiths in the world, and he can customize, if I'm correct, those letters were somewhat customized, and so he could say, hey, Mr. Settle, I have found through great research, which was kind of baloney, I have found through great research the official family coat of arms of the Settle family, and you too could have one for yourself, for a mere whatever, for an unreasonable fee. The genius of that offer was he converted very low-cost directory lists into a very targeted kind of offer, right? And of course, and again, you have to look at the time. I don't know how well. I don't know if that business even still exists. Does it? Do you know by any chance? I know Gary's passed away.
I'm not sure. I know he sold it to somebody, but I've never kept up with it.
Yeah, I think that's another example of a business that was perfect for the time. It was perfect for the 1960s. you know, and I don't know that people care anymore about their family coat of arms, but that was a time in history when that was something that caught people's attention. I think, by the way, I think if you did that in Latin America, where I am right now, where people still are very ancestor conscious, you know, if you said you too could own a copy of the official Diaz coat of arms for your house, I think there'd be a lot of people living in, you know, cinder block houses all over Latin America that would jump on that and would buy that thing and put the official Diaz coat of arms. You know, they may not have two sticks to rub together, but their last name is Diaz, right? And just how that worked in the States in the 60s, it might work very well in Latin America today. Just a thought. I mean, but the point is, you always, when you look at a successful letter, you always have to look at when was that letter mailed, what list was that letter mailed to, what were all the details surrounding that promotion. Again, not to take anything away from anybody's copywriting, but just to realize that, and this is important, there is no case where it's the copywriting alone that wins the day. Never. It's a pyramid, and the base of your pyramid is making sure that you're giving the right message to the right audience. All right, so we could hire the greatest copywriters in the world to create the greatest letters in the world. If we mail them to the wrong people, we're not going to make any sales. Conversely, if we've got somebody whose house is on fire, let's use a ridiculous example, and I hand them a scribbled letter or scribbled note saying, I'll put the house out, fire out right now, only $10, right. I will be the best copywriter with the best conversion rate that ever occurred in the history of man. All right, so we got to remember that. At the base, if you're imagining a pyramid, at the base of this pyramid is the right offer to the right person at the right time, which is your list, right? And your list segmenting and all the things that we talked about earlier in the call. The next level of the pyramid, equally as important, is an enticing offer. All right, so if I came to somebody and said, you know, I've got this great digital camera and it's only $1 million, I'm not going to make a sale. So it's got to be the right price, the right terms, the right, all those things you can do to modify an offer, make it attractive. So the offer is like the bait on the hook, right? And that's got to be good, right? So if you're sending the right message to the right person at the right time, and the offer itself is very powerful to that list, then the copywriting is what I call the point on the end of the spear, right? You need that. You know, you can't spear somebody with a blunt point. So you need that copy, and it's got to be good, and it's got to be as good as it can be. But if you don't have the right offer at the right time to the right people, you're just walking around with a spear point. There's no shaft to the spear. There's no soldier to hold the spear. It's just sort of this thing sitting on a table. It's beautiful. People can admire how well it's carved, but it's not going to do a thing. So that's important for when people look at copy. Copy is magic. I mean, copy can take a mundane business and make it a glamorous business. It can change destinies. It can take a money-losing business and make it profitable. It can take a modest business and take it worldwide. All those things are true. But you've also got to have the right offer to the right people at the right time, or the copy is just like so much, you know, glitter. It, you know, there it is, and then nothing happens.
What are some of, you know, we were talking about earlier, Gary Bensavenga. Who are some of your favorite copywriters that you learn from that you think people should be studying? Like someone, just, you know, the top two or three.
Oh boy. Well, you know, it really does matter, like, what field you're in, because it's hard to be, you can be, but it's hard to be a general purpose copywriter. For the reason is, part of a copywriter's job is to hit a market with precision, you know, write specifically to that market. So, you know, it's weird. Copywriting, you know, I forget who said this, but copywriting should be the glass on the store window. You know, in other words, you need the store window, because otherwise nothing would ever happen. But it's got to be invisible. It's like when I'm reading, like I might admire William Shakespeare, or I might admire the writing of Ernest Hemingway, and I might admire their stylistic things that they're doing. But when I'm looking at copy, I only care about one thing. Is this thing going to make me sell? Is this thing going to inspire me to buy? And so I have, I admire anybody that's ever made me buy anything, or not made me, but inspired me to try something. So I get inspiration from people like Gary Bensavenga, and certainly Gary Halbert, and you know, again, I'm always talking about John Caples, and even Claude Hopkins. I get inspiration from, but I don't necessarily ever read the copy and go, oh wow, you know, this is copy that I want to copy. You know, I don't know if I'm making sense about that, because good copy is invisible. Your prospect should not be going, wow, this is the best sales letter I've ever read. You know, I hate to hear that. Sometimes people will say that to me. Oh, that's a hell of a sales letter. I'm like, oh no, I don't want you to know it's a sales letter. I want you to just place an order. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And the guy who was talking about that, the window was the Eugene Schwartz seminar he did.
Oh, okay. And Eugene Schwartz, my God, what an amazing! I can't believe I forgot his name. What an amazing educator and person to study. Yes, you read their letters and you study them and you pull them, pick them apart, and you figure out, you know, why did he do this? Why did he do that? How does this work? Okay, cool, great. And then you look at the blank, you know, you go to your blank slate and figure out, okay, I've got this product. It's got these exciting things about it. It meets these particular needs. This audience has this particular orientation, and et cetera, et cetera. And how do I put all this into a stew and come out with something that is basically a transparent window that they're going to reach through to make a purchase? So really, this may sound bad, but I'm my own favorite copywriter because, you know, I know what went into the soup, you know, and so. I don't know if I'm making any sense on this, but I read everything that everybody does. I study. I certainly did this. You know, I spent hundreds of hours doing this when I was getting started. And the names I've given you are names that people I think are really great, great writers. They're also great. They also happen to be great educators. I like the copy that. Who's the guy that wrote My 60 Years in Advertising? It's an old book.
Claude Hopkins?
It's a guy that he started. It's a cool story. He started as a kid in Chicago. He was a Russian immigrant, and he got a job at Sears. And somehow,
Sackheim.
Oh, I love Sackheim's writing. Oh my God! And I like his writing. I like his storytelling. And you know who I like too is another book I recommend everybody get is Victor Schwab. Vic Schwab's book, How to Write an Advertisement. It's a great book. And of course, Drayton Bird's Common Sense and Digital Direct Marketing, or something like that. But Drayton's writing is fantastic too. I like their writing, and I like Gary's writing. I like Gary Bensavenga's writing, and I liked Gary Halbert's writing, just his writing when he would explain things and teach things. So those are writers I admire. And Dan Kennedy, of course, you know, really good teacher of copywriting. Those are the touchstones, the best. And I hope I'm not leaving anybody significant out. But I think everyone that I mentioned had heavy duty experience in the old paper and ink world, where you really had to work hard to make it work. There's not many, you know, internet only copywriters that I, you know, let's say follow closely. I mean, you're actually an exception to the rule because I said this at the beginning of the call. If you're a copywriter or aspiring to be a copywriter, Ben's put together a couple of books now at this point that I mean I have in my bookshelf and I find very inspiring and stimulating. You know, because that's a lot of what you're looking for. Is not necessarily pat answers, but you're looking for someone who's thought through the issues a lot and stimulates you to think. And Ben's books do that very well.
Thanks.
So those are guys I like.
Those are all good ones. I wanted to ask you definitely about this. Do you have this chapter that you titled Subtle But Deadly. And you were talking about how you were on the phone with someone and it was a great call, and then suddenly started trying to work you, like trying to work you, like out of the blue.
Remember that one? You've really read my book. I appreciate that. There's another guy who I'm pleased that he likes the book. His name is Martin Atkins, and he started his life as a punk rock drummer, and he played with Johnny Rotten, and if you know the world of, I don't know what that world is, progressive rock, I don't know what it is, I don't really follow it, but he's a known quantity, and now he teaches musicians how to be businessmen, and he's got his own studio, and he manages people, but he likes that book, he likes my book a lot too, and I'm really glad about that. Now that we've gone off on how glad I am that you like my book, tell me again what was the issue?
There was a chapter, it's toward the end, kind of toward the end of the book, it's my last chapters, and it's called Subtle But Deadly, and it was about how you were talking to some guy on the phone once, and it was a great call, and then suddenly he tried to start, like, working you, and it just, like, he turned into a salesman, and you were talking about how if you look at, like the best ads don't do that.
Exactly, and it's, boy, it's, you know, we're all... And this is a good time to bring up another book that everybody should read, which is Harry Brown's book, which we've got available. And I'm going to ask my assistant who's sitting here to go over to that pile of books there and get it for me. It's the blue one. I always forget the title, but it's The Secret of Selling Anything, I think. And Harry talks about that. And then there's another book that is recommended by Gary Bensavenga, which is How I Raise Myself from a Failure to a Success in Selling. And shame on me for not remembering the author, because he's an important...
Oh, that's Frank Betker.
Frank Betker.
Yeah.
Those are critically important books to get under your belt, have nearby at all times, read a little bit of every now and then, because they're books on selling. But they're books on authentic, what I would call authentic selling. Now, in contrast, we have a lot of sales techniques and schools of selling and NLP and, you know, mental mesmerizing. And, you know, where the model is, you're going to outsmart this prospect. You're going to bludgeon this prospect into submission using your superior mental and verbal powers. And that's a very dominant model in our world. And it is stupid. All right? It's stupid. I don't want to say anything more about it, because it's not even worth justifying. And yet it's the common paradigm. And a lot of us absorb that paradigm, even though we're not even aware of it. And when we go out as salespeople or we're trying to sell something, we're pulling, you know, techniques and trying to force things and trying to make things happen. You really can't make anything happen other than presenting the right message to the right person at the right time, and listening to the other person, right? If you're in a live sales situation, that's it. There's some craft always, and there's some skill, and a lot of that's discussed in Harry Brown's book, The Secret of Selling Anything. A lot of it's discussed in Betker's book, but the point is, you know, to recap the story that you were talking about, I was on the phone with this guy. He was sort of presenting something to me, his work and something that he does. And because at that time I was doing the seminars, and being on my stage was an incredibly valuable thing, you know, because you're in front of several hundred serious buyers. You're also listed on my faculty, which means tens of thousands of people all over the world are seeing your name repeatedly. I mean, being on my stage was a big deal. So I was always talking to people. They were always pitching me. And I was always interested, you know, whatever anybody had to say. So this guy was talking about his work. I found him fascinating. I found the work fascinating. I found the whole thing cool. And then in the last 10 minutes, I could feel it's like a switch flipped. And suddenly he was selling me, you know, he was getting all salesy on me. And it just killed the previous hour where I had nothing but positive feelings. Now, I didn't feel negative to the guy, you know, I didn't think, oh, this guy's a bad guy. But it's like it took what was a really something that was on the right track and put it on a mediocre, it took something that was on a great track, which was a natural, authentic conversation with relevant facts, and it put it on a mediocre track, which is, here's another guy trying to bamboozle me into, you know, getting something from me. And you have to be really careful with all the so-called copywriter guru advice out there, you know, that's floating around the internet, which it boils down to, here's how to trick your prospects into doing what you want them to do. Use this phrase, use this paragraph, use the, you know, this ticking clock and all this stuff. All that stuff has a place, and it's worth looking at, it's worth studying. But if that's all you're doing, if all you're doing is mimicking canned sales stuff, you're going to come across as a nuisance. Now, you still might make some sales, and there certainly have been people that have used this method and presenting to the right list at the right time. They may have sold a lot of stuff. But as I say in the foreword, because I published Harry Brown's book. He wrote it. It was a private manuscript that he used when he, in addition to being the libertarian candidate for president of the U.S. 2 times, in addition to being a New York Times bestselling author, in addition to having an extremely successful financial newsletter, when he was younger, he was a sales trainer. And he wrote this book, and he put it together, but it never saw the light of day. And speaking of Gary Bensavenga, Gary sent out a message saying, you know, this is the best book on selling ever written. So if Gary Bensavenga says that, I'm not going to waste any time. I immediately embarked on a detective quest, because it was very hard to find the electronic version of it. It was even harder to buy it. And I bought it, and I read it, and by goodness, by God, this was the best book. And I contacted the copyright owner, one of the heirs of Harry Brown, and I said, look, this is a masterpiece. It deserves to be in print. Would you allow me to print a limited edition of 1,000 copies? If, you know, and I'll pay you up front now. I'll pay you the whole royalty thing right now at the right now. You're like, you don't have to collect royalties from me. I'll pay you right now. So we printed 1,000 copies of this. I think we have maybe 200 and change left. But part of the thrill of this book was I was able to invite Gary Bensavenga to write the foreword, which he graciously agreed to do. I was over the moon about that. And so we've got his name on the cover, which makes me so happy. And then and then buried in here somewhere, I was able to write a publisher's foreword. And what I said was this, and this is relevant to what we're talking about right now. The fatal flaw of all manipulative techniques is that at the end of the day, they're degrading, degrading both to the practitioner and to the people on the receiving end of them. Also, from a strictly cold-blooded, practical point of view, manipulation is simply not sustainable. As the advertising genius David Ogilvy put it, the customer is not a moron. Eventually, even the slickest techniques become transparent and resented, and rightfully so. Fortunately, there's another approach to selling that respects both the sales pro and the prospect and happens to be fantastically effective. In fact, I'd venture to say you will find this approach at the core of every truly successful sales pro's philosophy. And that's part of my intro to the Harry Brown book, The Secret of Selling Anything. So, yeah, that's a big point in copywriting. Don't show up as a friend. I mean, imagine your friend invites you over, you go to his house, you're having a great conversation, you're having something to eat, you're having something to drink, he's telling you about something interesting he's doing, you're very interested, maybe you want to get involved, and then he breaks out the flip chart and the canned sales, you know, presentation. It's like, oh God, was this really a social thing, or did you just have me over to trick me into joining Amway or something? You know what I mean?
Yes, exactly.
Not to say it doesn't work. You know, this blunt force approach to life does work, but it's not comfortable. And I love it. Brown makes that point in his book. He says, look, if you're trying to be the manipulative salesman, you're going to be nervous when you're seeing prospects. You're going to be stressed. Selling is going to be hard. You're going to feel pressure. He says, if you drop all that and just become an authentic person with something of value for the person in front of you, and you're explaining that value as clearly and compellingly as you can, you're not going to feel any stress at all, and you're going to have many more sales, and everybody's going to be happy.
No, that's a great take on it. let's get into the let's get into this economic stuff, because this, you're one of the people who I always like reading whatever you write about on this subject, and a lot of people are like really, and this might not seem directly applicable to people's business and everything, but it is, you know, whatever happens in the economy. And can you just give us your take kind of on what's going on right now and maybe how to not only defend yourself against it, but maybe even profit from the situation?
Okay. You know, it's this, you know, the small business person, and that's us, the small entrepreneur, you know, has a lot of challenges. I mean, we got to make the cash register ring. We have people to pay. We've got products to sell. You know, our attention is completely absorbed in just getting things done. And it's just the way it is. But we always have to remember we're fish in a fishbowl. You know, we're not independent of what's going on in the larger economy. Now, to a certain extent, you know, you've got to, you know, just soldier on and not get depressed by the economic news. You know, that would be the stupidest thing to do. You know, see, you know, oh, wow, sales are down at Apple. Maybe that means sales will be down for me. Oh, I should just give up. I'm not advocating that approach, but I am advocating that you know what's going on in the larger economy, so that you can adapt and adjust your business to what's going on in the larger economy. A lot of business successes obviously flow from the effort and the intelligence of the entrepreneur, but if you remove the economic underpinnings to the business success, there wouldn't have been a business success. In other words, you know, to use a simple saying, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. So there was a while in the internet world where, you know, anybody could, in the guru world, where anybody could throw up any nonsense. And because there was a super amazing charge demand for information and a relative shortage of experts of any kind, legitimate or not, there was a little window where any idiot could get up there and make a nice presentation, make a ton of money. That was not the reflection of how smart that person was or how valuable their offering was. It was just a reflection of the fact there was a huge, hungry, hot market, and there just weren't that many providers. So you always have to be aware of, you know, what's beyond your own efforts. Let me give you another example. The colleague that I worked with in the digital post-production business, he just happened to get really – he's about 20 years older than me. So he just happened to get interested in film and filmmaking in the early 60s. Well, there was an explosion of television commercial production in the New York City area in the early 60s, and there was a screaming shortage of people who could simply put film in a camera and point it. I mean, it just people were rare. So as a 20-something-year-old guy, this guy was banking huge amounts of money, boy, like a 40-acre place up in the country, all as a young guy. But that market eventually, you know, like all markets, got filled. People went to film school. New technologies came out. People beyond New York City were suddenly making good TV commercials, and the market just disappeared. So he was as good a filmmaker as he ever was, but now it wasn't shooting fish in a barrel anymore. And now he had to compete with the people that were super slick marketers, which is why he diverged and created some new technology and went to a different direction. But so my point is you got to focus on your business. You got to be positive. You got to sell. You got to make your products as good as you can. You got to surround yourself with the best possible people, but you also have to watch the road. I guess I never thought of that analogy before, but you also have to watch the road and the road signs. And if the road sign says, "Bridge out," you better make sure your head was up and you saw that sign and make a detour. And this is what kills a lot of people in the long run. They've got a business that's making money. They've got a system. Their head's totally in the business. Everything's great. They're not watching the road signs. And they drive their business right off a cliff. There are a lot of people that used to be rich that aren't rich anymore. That happens. That always happens throughout history. And invariably, what you're going to find is they found a formula that worked, and they thought that the formula, that conditions would never change. One of the great things that Dan Kennedy knows and teaches, and those that really listen to him have learned, is that there is nothing permanent in this world. in this business environment. Things ebb and flow, and markets open and close. And I learned that very clearly as on the foreign exchange trading desk and watching those trades go down. A market opportunity would open, let's say, in a cross trade between the Japanese yen and the German Deutschmark, which doesn't exist anymore. But anyway, it would be open for 15 minutes, and anybody that saw that could take money out of the market by the truckload. But then the market would close, and that opportunity would be gone. Some opportunities last a year. Some opportunities last a decade. Some opportunities last a generation. Okay, this is all prelude to what I want to say right now. You know, as business people, we're like fish in the sea, and the sea goes up and the sea goes down. The tide goes out and the tide goes in. So where are we right now, and why does it matter? We are at the end, in my estimation, of a very long boom period, a boom period that was frankly fueled by funny money. And the central bankers and the banking industry's solution to every problem that has occurred since the 70s is create more money and lend it to more people at easier terms. And that's fine. That's legitimate. That's a way to juice an economy. That's a way to juice your business. You want to sell more products? Offer terms. Instead of making them pay 100% up front, let them make a down payment and make payments. That's a legitimate marketing technique. The problem is it doesn't last forever. And we pretty much loaned, you know, as much money. You know, we've got governments in debt, from the federal government to the state governments. I mean, my God, I think gas stations won't even honor state of Illinois credit cards anymore. I mean, so we've got states. The federal government is obviously overextended. They can, of course, create more money. You have state governments that are overextended. They cannot create more money except by taxation. You have local governments that are overextended. You have school districts that are overextended. You have businesses that are overextended. You have individuals that are overextended. And, my God, we have this generation, and it's tragic, of families that went out and bought the $500,000 house and then sent their kid to the $100,000 school, thinking that it was never going to end. Well, now the $500,000 house is worth $200,000, and the $100,000 education, you know, get somebody a job managing, you know, a McDonald's or something. We're at the end of this, and this is something that happens in history all the time. You get, you know, people are disciplined and they work hard and they save their money and they invest and they're frugal, and then some prosperity occurs, and then that prosperity is leveraged, and it's leveraged again, and it's leveraged again. And next thing you know, like, you know, in Paris in the 1700s, there was this brief period where everybody in Paris was a millionaire. And that's actually where the word millionaire came from. There, without making the story too long, there was a stock bubble, and everybody was buying and selling shares in this crazy stock bubble, and even coachmen, you know, the guys that would ride you around in a coach, they were millionaires. Everybody had stock, and the stock was always going up, and everybody was rich, and it was always fantastic until it stopped. And then it was such a traumatic experience that France did not use paper currency again for 80 years. Right? They just said, we're not dealing in paper anymore, because that's how bad the burn was. So I'm afraid everything that I look at tells me that we're at the end of a long, ever-inflating, leveraged boom period, and we are going to a period of deleveraging. All right, what does deleveraging mean? Here's the reality of loaned money. Every loan is always paid in full. Okay, you might go, what? That's not true. Well, I didn't say who paid it in full. Either the buyer, either the guy that borrowed the money pays it back in full, or the lender pays it in full by having to write it off out of his own pocket. So we are going to see a lot of paper bonds, municipal bonds, corporate bonds, junk bonds, loans that banks have made. We're already seeing it. Mortgages. We're going to see mountains. It's already started, but I think we're at the beginning of the avalanche, not at the end. We're going to see inconceivably large amounts of defaults on all kinds of loans all over the place. And you might say, well, how's that going to affect me? That is going to create, believe it or not, a shortage of U.S. dollars. And I know everybody says the dollar is going to go to nothing and the dollar is trash and the renminbis, the Chinese renminbi is going to take over the world. All that might happen in time, like long time, but in the immediate, what I'm looking at right now, and I've made a huge bet on this, and if I'm wrong, it's going to hurt. I've given more than a little thought into this, and I'm going to give a link that people can go listen to. And there's nothing to buy, even. You know, it's just a conversation I have with a guy named Robert Prechter, who's the publisher of the Elliott Wave Theory Letter, who's one of the most respected guys in technical analysis on the planet. And this is his view too. And if you look at the logic of it, it's hard to escape the logic. When all these loans collapse, everybody's going to be scrambling around for dollars to replace the value of the loans that they thought were valuable, and now they are worth nothing. And there's going to be a scramble for just plain cash. Now we see that, and people go, no, cash is useless. Cash is trash. Cash is nonsense. Well, let me tell you something. In 1979, only an idiot would have bought real estate in Manhattan. The market for real estate in Manhattan was depressed and looking more depressed every day. It was a train wreck. Anybody that bought their co-op when it was made for sale in the 70s was considered reckless and nuts. Hey, why are you buying it when you could rent it? Okay, I'm telling you, I was there. 79, nobody was buying residential property in Manhattan. You were an idiot to do so. Well, now look, right? Now it's some of the most valuable stuff on earth. In 1999, and I was there and I wrote about this, nobody was buying gold. Nobody. Every central bank was selling gold. It was like a fire sale. Hey, $300 an ounce. Take it. We don't want it. You were an idiot if you bought gold. Okay? All right. Now I'm not saying I'm right about cash, but I'll tell you this. Right now, every smart, informed investor will tell you that cash is the worst thing to be holding. You're not getting a return on your money. You're losing to inflation, blah, 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 blah. Let me show you how that's wrong right now. It's 2005. You've got $500,000 cash. You could bury it in the ground. That would be stupid, right? Or you could do the smart thing and buy a condo in Miami. Okay, who made more money in 2005, faced with that decision? The guy that buried his cash in the ground. I'm not saying bury cash in the ground, by the way. That's metaphorical.
Right, right.
The guy that bought real estate right before it peaked out, his real estate went down, which meant what? The value of the cash in his pocket went up, because if he had waited, he could have bought twice as much real estate. Here's the key, and this is what's so hard for people to grasp. There is no place where you can go to see a chart that shows the relative value of cash. There's no chart that goes, okay, dollar is now worth this much real estate, and therefore the dollar has risen 100%. You know, there's certain markets where you would have gotten 100% return on your money had you simply buried it in the ground, not bought the real estate, and let's say bought it 2 years later. We're going to see the same thing in stock. Well, you know what? We're seeing it in Apple, right? Wasn't Apple supposed to go to $1,000 a share? I don't think so. And I guarantee, I gave this talk at Wharton Small Business in 2000 when there was still some steam in the internet business. And I said it, and it's on tape, and I'm glad it's on tape. I said, you want to own internet shares? Wait a year. You'll be able to buy anything you want for pennies on the dollar. I was 100% right. And I think, nobody knows the future, I think I'm right about stocks and bonds, and I think real estate as well. Real estate, you have to understand, is being treated in this weird environment that we're in the last 30 years as a financial instrument. Okay? Your home is not a financial instrument. It's where you go to get out of the rain. Okay? And, you know, for instance, when my dad bought a house for $40,000 way back in the distant mists of time, he was making $40,000 a year. There used to be, and he was very conservative, there used to be ratios. If you made X, you could afford X, you know, plus 50%. How many people who make $40,000 a year these days buy a $40,000 house, or even an $80,000 house, or even a $150,000 house? Everybody wants the $200,000. Well, now it's changing. But until this bubble burst in real estate, everybody was buying the $250,000, the $350,000. I can't tell you how many guys I knew went out and bought million-dollar houses. And I'm like, really? Really? Are you serious? You really think that this is, these values are going to hold? Well, they didn't hold, and a lot of those million-dollar houses are now unsellable at half a million, and that's just going to increase. So what happened? What went crazy? Well, everybody got this notion, and the banks encouraged it, that you buy a house as an investment, and it goes up 10 or 15% a year, and American real estate never goes down. That's how they sold these crap mortgage bonds all over the world. Oh, real estate in America. Now, real estate in America might be a nice thing to own, but everything's nice to own at the right price, but certain things are not good to own at the wrong price. So I think American real estate, I think it's a good idea to buy it at the price that it was being sold at pre-crash. Not a good idea at all. And it was the result of decades of this ever-growing credit-fueled bubble. You know, hey, can you breathe? We'll give you a mortgage for $500,000. Yeah, you don't have to verify your income. You don't have to verify your savings. You don't have to verify anything. Just prove that you can sign a piece of paper. That's how extreme it got. I hope people realize that that's where we were when it burst. That insane availability of credit is what allowed prices to leave the planet. Prices have to come down. There has to be a natural ratio, a realistic ratio between what somebody earns and the value of the house they live in. So I live very modestly. I always have. It may be genetic because my grandfather, who did very well as a masonry contractor, he always lived in this little house in the Bronx. And I used to visit my grandma, and I go, why are you living here? You know, you should live in Scarsdale, or you should live in some. They like their little house, and you know what? It took a lot of pressure off them. And the horse is sort of out of the barn for everybody. Everybody feels they need these 5,000 square foot houses, and you really don't, and you really don't know that need that kind of pressure. But anyway, point is, we're going to see a lot of deflation, not necessarily in the price of things in stores that, you know, like oranges and toothpaste, but you're going to see deflation. We're already seeing it in real estate. I think it's going to continue. I think it has to continue until it gets down to a reasonable level again. The prices of stocks, the interest rates, that, you know, bonds are like a weird thing. They fluctuate with what the interest rates in the market are. But let me tell you this: if you own a bond at a low interest rate, if you own a bond at 4% and interest rates go to 10% and they can't go there, the price of your bond just took a massive scalping, like cut off at the neck. So you have to understand that bonds are not safe. Bonds are safe in a very stable, you know, undynamic environment. We're not in that environment. And someday these low interest rates are going to have to stop. And when they stop, you're going to see bond defaults going out the moon, right? So I don't know if I'm being articulate about this, but let me give you a link, everybody, who wants to follow this. It's kenmccarthy.com/blog/which-way-the-economy, which-way-the-economy. So if you go to my blog and you look for Which Way the Economy, I have an interview with Robert Prechter about the phenomenon of deflation and what it's going to mean. And it's password protected, and it's for friends only. And like I was telling Ben earlier, any friend of Ben is a friend of mine. So, and there's nothing to sell. We're not going to try to, you know, upsell you into some kind of mastermind apprenticeship course in investing, because Prechter makes the point in our interview. I'll give you a little sneak preview. The average person shouldn't be investing. The average person should be learning a skill, could be marketing, building a business, making that business run really smoothly, saving their money, and being extremely conservative and not listening to the siren song of Wall Street. But anyway, the password is, and don't tell anybody, it's club only. It's one string, club only. So when you go to this article, Which Way the Economy, you're going to be presented with it's going to say protected. If you put in lowercase club only and click on that, you'll be able to listen to the whole interview with me and Prechter. And we go into this in a little bit more detail. It's a, you know, I'm presenting, I know for most people, this is a way of thought that you may not have encountered before. And here's why you haven't encountered it. CNBC, Fox Business, and all these other clowns are really, from a business point of view, nothing more than a 24/7 infomercial for buying and selling stocks. Who are their advertisers? They're brokerage companies. Okay. Do you think CNBC could run shows that talk about the fact that there's going to be a massive retracement of stock prices, that stock prices are insanely overvalued, that it doesn't make sense for the average person to be in stocks? How many times do you think that show would run on CNBC before the phone would ring and Fidelity would say, you better stop running this stuff or we're not going to run our ads anymore? And if you don't think the world works that way, it works exactly that way. So CNBC and Fox News and all these other clowns are nothing more than cheerleaders for Wall Street. And Wall Street, you know, feels that the best thing for them to do is sell you their stuff, which is sort of understandable when they do it ethically, the rare cases where they do. But that doesn't mean it's right. It doesn't mean that that's what you should be doing. So the problem is we have all the financial media in the world is acting as if we're kind of in a normal environment and there, you know, happy days are here again and everything's okay. Well, I'm here to tell you, if you look at the numbers and you look at the debt levels are just flat out unsustainable. And the answer to debt that can't be paid is default. And the answer to default and the fallout from default is a lot of people that thought they had valuable paper, valuable stock, valuable real estate, any kind of a financialized instrument, valuable bonds, is going to find out they don't have something so valuable. So the good news is people are still going to eat. They're still going to buy clothes. They're still going to want to educate themselves and their children. Normal life is going to go on, but there will be a dislocation. And that happened in the 30s. And a lot of the very best direct marketers, a lot of the most interesting businesses around, even today, got started in the 1930s when people had to change their point of view and focus on value. Let me give you an example. Do we still have time? I'm ranting on here, Ben. I hope it's okay.
No, this is fine. Keep going.
Here's an example of how someone adjusts to the depression. And a depression is very scary because it means no jobs, and no jobs being no ability to pay your rent. I mean, it's frightening, okay? But this is where improvisation comes in, all right? So we had a guy who had a business called Chock Full of Nuts, all right? If you're in New York City, you'll recognize that brand name. It's a big brand name, and I'll explain in a second. He started this business in the 20s, and what he was doing was selling shelled nuts on the street corners. He had a bunch of different stands. And people were buying them, and he was getting rich. The Depression came, and a lot of people were out of work, and a lot of people didn't have much money, and dollars were really valuable, therefore scarce. And people were so poor in the Depression, they didn't have the money to buy shelled nuts. So this guy was looking at all these stands going, well, what the heck am I going to do? So he started a lunch counter instead. He called it Chock Full of Nuts. And at that lunch counter, he sold food really cheaply to people. And a lot of people who were broke and, you know, needed help would come and they'd get a really good, valued food, you know, at a good price. And it was a great business. It was the right business for the right time. See, if you create, remember I said right offer, right person, right time. You know, if there's a war going on, if there's an earthquake going on, if there's a depression going on, if you've got the right offer for the right business at the right time, you're going to make money. If you do not watch the road signs and you watch CNBC and you think you never have to think about the larger economy, you may run right off the road. So what this guy did was he changed from selling his, you know, these shelled nuts to a lunch counter, a low cost, high value, delicious lunch counter. He made money. Then he introduced coffee, and his coffee was very popular. And he called, because the store was, the original was called Chock Full of Nuts, and the lunch counter was called Chock Full of Nuts, he called the coffee Chock Full of Nuts. Well, Chock Full of Nuts today is a massive brand in the New York area. I don't know how it is in other parts of the country, but I guarantee the family or the corporation or the mega corporation that owns the Chock Full of Nuts brand is very happy because they are selling tons of coffee every day to at least the major metropolitan area, which is about 18 million people. So there's an example of a guy he had a business that was working. The outer world changed radically. He improvised with something modest, and then he kept his eyes open, and he exploited the opportunities that were made available to him step by step. Next thing you know, he has an amazing coffee brand, and that's how the world works. And that's why it's important to be aware of the larger economy that you're in. And I think, like it or not, we're in a time where there's going to be a big shift really fast. And it's not like this never happened before. And anybody that wants to prepare, just go look at the kinds of businesses and the kinds of offers and the kinds of value that were offered by successful entrepreneurs in the Depression, okay? Things that worked in the 90s and the 80s and the 2000s worked great then. They ain't going to work in a Depressionary era, okay? So that's my sermon on that. So everybody take advantage of my blog and that article, Which Way the Economy, and the password is Club Only.
Wow, that's awesome. It's
okay.
Really good to know this stuff. You know, you're not going to learn this from the latest internet marketing, you know, joint venture launch. You know what I mean? So that's why I wanted to ask you about that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So where can people learn more about you, and how can they find you and see what you're offering and your blog? I mean, you mentioned your blog, but any other sites or anything like that?
Oh, you know, a good thing to do is go to the kenmccarthy.com, and there's a blog there. My book is there, which is a great low-cost way to get introduced to my work. And then, you know, we've got more advanced courses, and you know, if you're aware of them, you know, you're already aware of them, and you should get them. If you're not aware of them, a great place to start is the book, because it will give you the philosophy of business and you know, how things work in the real world. And, you know, you'll see, hey, do I believe this, what this guy's saying? Do I like his point of view or not? And then from there, then you can make the decision, hey, I want to get the more expensive course.
Sounds good. Well, hey, I appreciate you doing this. This has been really, really cool, and especially the economic stuff and all the other things we talked about.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Obviously, you can tell. I love thinking about this stuff. I like talking about it when people will listen.